Hi everyone, welcome to this episode of Diverse Talk Matters.
To talk about different things around diversity, equity, inclusion, talk about things that people may find challenges with, so we hope you find them really useful. Some are around people's different lived experiences, some really challenging conversations, things that sometimes we don't need to talk about. But we really hope you enjoy the range of topics that we are introducing to you or bringing to you, to your homes, to your house, your workplaces.
We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Diverse Matters podcast. I am your host, Michaela Sinead. We are today going to be speaking about the language that we're using around disability. And we have two fantastic guests from the Diverse Matters community in Lex and Sarah. I'm going to let them introduce themselves in just a moment. But in this podcast episode, expect to hear good things, interesting things, and important takes to take forward, not only for you in your everyday, but in the workplace as well. So I'd love to introduce Lex first. Lex, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Hello. I am Lex Karagiorgis. My pronouns are he, him, and I am a consultant for Diverse Matters. And I deliver training on all sorts of topics, disability inclusion being one of them. I myself am disabled. I'm neurodivergent. I have multiple mental health conditions. And I also studied disability inclusion quite in depth at university as well. Really passionate about disability inclusion. Really excited to be here. Thank you, Michaela, for having me.
No worries. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you. And next we have Sarah. Sarah, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Hello, I'm Sarah Teichler and I'm a Diverse Matters Associate Consultant. I've been with Diverse Matters for, I think, around 4 or so years. And I deliver training like Lex. And I've also been involved in some policy audits of organisations and little bits and pieces related to accessibility and disability. I've been involved in the field of disability and accessibility for more than 20 years now in various different roles. I'm a non-disabled person, but I very much consider myself to be an ally and I'm very passionate about disability and the inclusion of disabled people. I also have a son who is a disabled person and studied disability studies as well. Yeah, very pleased to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sarah. Okay. So I'm gonna kick right off with the first question to set the scene, if you like, okay? Because it will give good context for the rest of the episode, I would say. Sarah, I'm coming to you first. Can you share what the social model definition of disability is and how folks can use the model?
Yeah, sure, definitely. I think it's really good to refer to it as a scene setter because I think it absolutely underpins any kind of conversation about disability or the inclusion of disabled people. So it's a really good one to start with. So I was going to start off by explaining what the medical model of disability is, because it's important to understand that to see how and where the social model differs. So the medical model of disability is the sort of traditional, in inverted commas, way of thinking about disability, and it's been around for centuries. Essentially, the medical model says that the disadvantages and exclusion that disabled people face are caused by what they can't do. And again, and I'm using inverted commas here. So the medical model says, for example, that the reason a person with mobility impairments can't get into a building with stairs at the entrance is because they can't walk. Or the reason that a person with dyslexia might find exams difficult is because they struggle with reading and writing. So it's very much focused on the person's impairment or condition and what their bodies can or can't do. The social model, on the other hand, completely turns that on its head and instead says that the disadvantages and exclusion that disabled people face are caused not by their impairments, but the fact that society as a whole has completely failed to take account of those impairments or conditions and has created a world that's full of barriers that prevent disabled people from just doing things and getting on with their lives. The reason that a person with a mobility impairment can't get into a building with stairs at an entrance is because someone decided to put the stairs there in the first place. And the reason that someone with dyslexia might find exams difficult is actually because someone decided that exams that rely on reading and writing was a good way to check people's knowledge and skills, which obviously in lots of cases it's not. Because the medical model focuses on an individual's impairments and conditions, the solution it leads to are based around fixing the individual through medical interventions. which some people might find that medical intervention is helpful in some cases, but disabled people have for a long time been subject to medical interventions that are painful or stressful or cause other problems like long hospital stays or unpleasant side effects of medications. There's real sort of negatives in looking at that as a solution for removing that disadvantage and exclusion. But because the social model focuses on barriers within society, then the solutions it leads to are based around removing those barriers, or even better, not putting them there in the first place. And the social model also makes clear that it's everybody's responsibility for removing barriers. We're all part of this system that puts the barriers in the way in the first place. And unless we're part of the solution, i.e. removing them, then we're part of the problem, whether intentional or not. So we're all in this together, and we can't look at this as a minority issue. I've been talking about society in a really general way because disabled people face that disadvantage and exclusion in all aspects of life. But the social model of disability is a really good starting point for organisations to think about how they better include and better meet the needs of their disabled employees. It's simply about identifying and removing barriers. It's absolutely crucial to this understanding the social model of disability is the fact that it was and it continues to be developed by disabled people. There's not a new idea. It's been around since the sort of 60s and 70s. And was first developed by groups of disabled people who came together to start challenging the assumptions made about them and the way in which that led to segregation in their lives and having little control over their lives. And the term social model of disability was coined in the 1980s by a guy called Mike Oliver, who is really worth looking into more. Some organisations are only just getting to grips with the idea of the social model of disability. And it's often considered to be this new idea, but it's really not. It's been around for a very long time. But unfortunately, no one outside the disabled people's movement was listening at that time.
I just want to, just mention that the medical model does have a role to play in certain contexts. For example, like some disabled people might need pain relief interventions. But in those cases, they will be working with doctors, with clinicians to essentially target that, to essentially have that element of medical intervention. So what I always say to people is, yes, the medical model has a role to play, but the medical model is essentially none of our business. The medical care that disabled people get, the medical care that anybody gets, is between them and their doctors. And so in our line of work, we are not in the business of giving medical advice, of proposing medical interventions. We're in the business of businesses and how businesses work and how businesses operate and are structured. And so that's very much why we use the social model so much and why we don't talk about the medical model. The medical model has a role to play, but only in a medical context.
Thank you. I think that's really interesting how this is not new. There has been the work already. Work has been done. So there are places to reference. There are organizations to go and engage with and people to read up on, right? Like folks, there's the research out there. And there's people that can help out with this model as well. And yes, there's going to be nuance and yes, there's going to be evolution to it, but it's not brand new, folks. Lex, I'm going to come to you now and I'm going to ask around like identity. Okay. So how do we talk about the disabled community? Is it in a person first or is it a identity first or is it something completely else?
Person first versus identity first. Person first language is language like people with disabilities, people with autism. I always advocate for use identity first language. So talking about disabled people, autistic people. And that's because it very much takes into account the social model of disability. So when we're talking about disabled people, we are saying people are disabled because of society. People are disabled because of the barriers that are in place. They don't have disabilities. They are disabled by structures and systems. Of course, some individual people do prefer person-first language for themselves. So on an individual level, I would always recommend, if you know that somebody is disabled, always recommend just asking them, hey, do you prefer person-first or identity-first? But when you're talking about whole communities, I always advocate for using identity-first. I mentioned autistic people specifically. This is also a subject that comes up quite often within the autistic community and outside the autistic community. So I myself am autistic. I talk about myself as being an autistic person, not a person with autism. And that's because being autistic has been so heavily medicalized and it's been essentially portrayed as a problem, something wrong with you. It's a condition that you have. But my autisticness is a very core part of who I am. There's nothing wrong with me. It's not a condition. So like, I am autistic. I don't have autism. But to summarize, identity first when you're talking about whole groups, but when you're talking to individuals, it's always worth just double checking because some people do have their own preferences.
Thank you, Lex. I think that's a really important point as well in terms of that asking folks, right? Like, what do you prefer? What works for you? Have there been any occasions where people have asked you that it's gone really well or it hasn't gone so well? Again, I can imagine there's going to be people who are a bit nervous about that conversation. Are there any examples that you can share?
So one example I can think of was a very recent one. I actually took part in a piece of research that looked at autistic people and their use of online spaces and online communities. And right at the beginning of the interview, the researcher specifically asked whether they should refer to me in their report as an autistic person or a person with autism. And the researcher consistently asked that of every single one of their participants. And that level of nuance is always so greatly appreciated. So yeah, whenever people can or whenever people have the opportunity to just clarify, do you prefer person first or identity first? I would always say just go for it because it is always much appreciated and shows a level of understanding that I personally value a lot.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing, Lex. Sarah, did you want to add something?
The only example that I can think of using person first language is people with learning difficulties. But that is a term that has been chosen by people with learning difficulties. And I think it's similar to that sort of it being integral to somebody's identity. Yeah, basically that's the self-chosen term by that particular community of disabled people.
I'm getting the vibe that it's very nuanced with all of this, right? And the important thing with all of the communication, with all of the language that we're using, is we're checking in with the folks and the communities that it's applicable to and the individuals that it's applicable to. Take the time, make the effort, do the work, do the research and correct. Like that seems to be the clear cut thing that I'm getting wonderfully from both of you here. And yeah, that can be scary and yeah, that can be nervous. But again, just thinking about how much easier you're making it on the other person by showing that care, that consideration. It may be awkward, but push through. And just let's make it less awkward. Let's do that work. Okay, Sarah, I'm coming back to you for the next question. So what could people do if they aren't clear on the language to use, especially if they've got it wrong in the past? Yes, we've already discussed that folks have different preferences. How do you make it less awkward? How can people deal with this?
I think, first of all, it's really important to say that this fear of saying the wrong thing often leads to non-disabled people completely avoiding talking to disabled people, which is really terrible. And it probably doesn't matter how wrong you get it. That has got to be better than actually not talking to somebody because you're worried about what you're going to say to them. I definitely agree that asking is really absolutely crucial, but also just listening as well, because sometimes you'll be able to pick up on the way that people are talking about themselves and mirror that back. If someone says, I have a disability, then that's obviously that their preference in terms of language, and not to go around saying, no, you're wrong. You have an impairment. You are a disabled person, but you have an impairment. So I think just listening to what people are saying is really key. I think it is, however, really important that you do educate yourself about what the most appropriate language to use is. And I think hopefully what's come out from what we've said so far is that although it is nuanced, it is that kind of social model, identity first kind of language that should be your kind of starting point if you're not sure about what to use. And if you're talking about kind of communities in general, having disability equality training is incredibly important, and that will help you to learn more about what up-to-date appropriate language is, as is following disabled activists on social media. I'm not a very social media-y person. So if you don't do social media, look at articles and websites, particularly disabled people's organisations. Looking at those will help to give you a flavour of what sort of language should be used. For example, the National Autistic Society have a whole thing on their website about using autistic person rather than using person with autism. So you'll find that it's a topic that disabled people's organisations are talking about. I think from a point of view of worrying about whether you're saying the wrong thing, no one's going to expect you to be an expert. And because people have different preferences, you're not always going to get it right. And I think the key thing really is just in the same way that you would with anybody else on any other topic, you're looking out for whether you've offended the person. So sometimes people might tell you, actually, I'd prefer if you didn't use that language, or I prefer it if you used this language instead. But if not, you're just picking up on body language or facial expression or some other means that somebody might tell you that you've said something they prefer you don't. And apologise, ask what better way of saying it is, draw a line under it and move on. And don't let it stop you from talking to a disabled person or talking about disability more generally in future. That's really key. We're all human. We all make mistakes. Educate yourself as best you can, but accept that sometimes you're not going to get it right. And yeah, give yourself a break.
That's reassuring. Thank you, Sarah. And yeah, I completely agree. The apologising and meaning it when and if you get it wrong, and then that course correct is so very important. Prove that you took it on board. Absolutely. Have there been any examples that you've seen folks correct themselves course correct? Anything that you've seen that's been done well in terms of that? Oh, there's been a mistake. We're not going to dwell, but we are going to move forward effectively.
Well, Lizzo released a song that, if I remember correctly, originally when it was released, it had ableist language in it. And then when it became clear to her that the language was ableist, when the community made her aware, she just changed it. She apologised, that was it. And I think that's the really important thing to remember is when somebody calls you out on something, it's not personal. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're a failure and you're a bad person. It means that you made a mistake, but try to avoid getting defensive about it, right? So just correct yourself, move on, no harm, no foul, as long as you learn from it. So when you said, can you think of any example? That was the one that really came to mind. And if you contrast that with, for example, when Sia made that movie called Music, which sparked a lot of criticism. And when you look at the defensiveness that came out of that, the complete resistance to learn from it or to change. Yeah, that's an example of things possibly handled not so well.
High profile examples like that are good for opening the debate and talking about it. And I think the fact of talking about it is a good starting point, isn't it? Obviously, people's attitudes need to change, and it's not good that these things happen in the first place. But we're talking about it in a way that even 10 years ago, people weren't talking about it.
Absolutely. And that brings me on to the next question. So thanks for that segue. When we're talking about language and we're talking about how language has evolved and changed, and it does, and there are these everyday phrases that we can use or have used or maybe we don't use anymore. But Lex, I'd really love to come to you next to understanding how people can reflect on these everyday phrases, this everyday language, and its effect on stigmas and assumptions when we're talking about disability.
I honestly, where do I even begin? Because there are so many examples of everyday language that is just so commonplace and so widely used, but so stigmatizing. So, for example, when people say, oh, I'm so OCD today, or oh, the weather's being really bipolar, or even worse, the weather's being really schizophrenic, it just serves to really heavily disabled people's experiences. And essentially makes us the butt of a joke. But it also completely minimizes and invalidates just how distressing can be to have, for example, OCD. I myself have experience of OCD, and it is not just rearranging things a little bit. Like in my personal experience, it can be really debilitating. There are activities that I just cannot engage with because they are too triggering for my OCD. I can't do them. So it's not, oh, if you're a clean and tidy person, then you have OCD. that's not what it is. But then there are other examples that are probably more commonplace. I myself have been trying to train that out of my own language, and you'd be surprised how hard it is, because it is just so embedded and ingrained. But actually, when you think about it, what does the word crazy mean? It is a stigmatizing word that stigmatizes especially people with mental health conditions. A less used word, psycho. And then on the kind of more severe end of the scale, you have slurs. Like the R slur is used so consistently still. And it is probably one of the few slurs that is still in very heavy use. And when it's called out, it's just a joke, it's just a word, but it's a slur. It's a slur that essentially makes people with learning disabilities the butt of the joke. So honestly, there are so many examples. I guess what I would advise and really encourage people to do is reflect on the language that you use. If you are calling people crazy, think about what is that? What message is that sending? Not just to the people around you, but what message is that sending to disabled people? And they're consistently hearing that to be disabled is essentially to be an insult to others. So just reflect on it and try to alter the language you use. And that requires a lot of mindfulness and self-reflection. And it is a consistent process. I still slip up sometimes. It does take time. But honestly, I cannot emphasize enough what a difference that will make to the people around you, and especially to the disabled people around you and to the disabled community more generally.
Thank you, Lex. There's going to be slip-ups, there's going to be mistakes, but that consciousness that just like you are aware, because once you see or what it's brought to your attention, you then can't unsee it or you can't ignore. So then how do you move forward with it? And that reflection piece and that mindfulness and that deep consideration, I think, is so very important and can be difficult because you have to inwardly look. There can be those cringe moments when you think about things that were said, and can be levels of shame with that people will have to deal with as well, and still move forward and still course correct. Okay. That's going to be the case. Okay. Address it. That's how we can move forward. But it's not always easy, is it? It's not. I'd love to come to you on this, Sarah, and in the work that you're doing and having this conversation. I know is something, there's a point that came up in our pre-conversation. There's some phrases that you just said, we need to just put them in the bin. They need to be gone. So what are some of the phrases, Sarah, that we just need to stop in 2023?
Oh, again, there are so many. So one of my real bugbears is the term fully accessible. And the reason it often gets used to describe things that are usually accessible for wheelchair users. So if you've got step-free access into a building and you've got an accessible toilet, or fully accessible, but who are you accessible to? Disabled people have different access requirements, and you might have your step-free access in your accessible toilet, but if you don't have any hearing loops, then you're not going to be accessible to deaf people who wear hearing aids. If you've got the highly patterned carpets or wallpaper or really loud noises or really bright lights, you're not going to be accessible to some people who are neurodivergent. It doesn't really mean anything when people use it. And I think it's always a sort of treat with caution. It's much better if you want to talk about the access that you have within your workplace, for example, be really specific. What do you mean? What access provisions are in place and what barriers are in place? Yeah, just be specific. And I think also it's important to remember that actually disabled people's access requirements sometimes conflict. So it's a fully accessible should be a sort of desire for an end game, but the conflicts between people's access requirements can sometimes mean that doesn't happen. And a really simple example of this is with like curbs. Some visually impaired people need curbs to be able to navigate and make sure that they don't step into the roads. Wheelchair users and other people who need step-free access can't get across a road if it's got a curb. So you end up with a dropped curb, but you have to put tactile paving in so that a visually impaired person can feel where the pavement is. But then that ends up being difficult for some people with poor balance or conditions that cause pain if you're walking on uneven ground. So it's not a straightforward do X, Y, Z and it'll be perfect for everybody. There's always going to be conflicts. And I know I'm using built environment examples because that's one of my things. It applies to any sort of aspect of the world. There will always be conflict. So I think if we could just be in fully accessible, that would be awesome and would make it much clearer in terms of what we're talking about and being able to address the barriers that still exist. Special needs was one that you'd mentioned previously, Michaela, and about, not that you'd used it, but that you'd mentioned it as one that we might want to be in. And absolutely, I think it's something that people get really tied into knots with because they hear the phrase special educational needs in the context of education. And they think that that makes it acceptable to apply to all disabled people in all sort of circumstances. And I think that there's a whole debate about whether special educational needs is still an appropriate term for schools. But if we set that aside, because that's linked with the legislation, et cetera, set that aside for now, it's absolutely not an appropriate term to refer to a disabled person in any other context at all. So we should completely bin that. Everybody has, every human has needs in terms of the ways that they do things. I had a colleague, she is a wheelchair user, and she was talking about, if I go into a training room and there are no chairs for people to sit on to do the training, that doesn't bother me because I've brought my own chair. It's the people that need to sit who have that need. So it's not a special need. It's not, it's just a need. We all have needs. Yeah. And there's also so many connotations around the word special because special is essentially what separates one thing from something else. It's about differentiation, segregation. And yeah, it also has connotations of being childlike and innocent, which are stereotypes that are often applied to disabled people. Special needs, just bin it. But yeah, disabled people, not people with special needs, and access requirement, not special needs. I would bin able-bodied because it's inaccurate and it's just that disabled people don't have bodies that are able to do anything, which is just ridiculous. Non-disabled is the term to use, and able-bodied you hear like all over the place. So yeah, let's please bin that one. I also want to put a blanket ban on wheelchair bound and confined to a wheelchair, which again, you hear those phrases all the time. And no one is bound or confined to a wheelchair. And those terms have these connotations of being trapped somehow when actually wheelchairs are there to provide freedom and mobility and independence. So wheelchairs are not a thing that you get trapped in. I don't know if differently abled, which is, it's a bit of a US term, but I've heard people use it here as well. I think some people think the word disabled is an offensive term. So they're looking for something a bit softer and nicer to replace it with. And differently abled, yeah, it should definitely be binned. We are all able to do different things. And again, it has that kind of link with bodies and minds and impairments and conditions rather than barriers. And there's also things like the blind, the deaf, the disabled, when talking about people as a group. That's very dehumanizing, takes away people's unique experiences and unique value. So let's bin that. One other thing, talking about accessible things as disabled. So disabled toilet, disabled parking, disabled entrance, they're just accessible and they're for everybody. And that's the one thing that's brilliant about being more accessible and inclusive is that it benefits everybody. So call them accessible.
Honestly, we need to throw all of the euphemisms for disabled in the bin. Just throw them in the bin. Disabled is not a bad word. It's not a dirty word. I am disabled by society. People are disabled by society. Our needs aren't special. We have different needs, maybe sometimes to other people, but that's the same for everybody, disabled or not. We all have different requirements and different needs. For example, a parent might need to work part-time. That's not a special need. It's just a need. Or somebody who suffers with autism or suffers with neurodivergent conditions. And it's this kind of, this victimization of disabled people. So we need to stop that. Yeah, I can't remember if it was a BuzzFeed video or a BBC Three video, but it was a video done by people with Down syndrome reading out kind of assumptions or common phrases one of the phrases that suffers with syndrome. Mm. And she said something fantastic, and I'm going to quote her right now. She said, "The only thing I suffer from is bad attitudes." And I could not have said it better, because genuinely, I don't suffer because of my disabilities. I quote unquote suffer because society and the world outside is not accessible and is not great at meeting my requirements in order to be able to access society. So, been that.
This is a complete value judgment about somebody's life. We've got, who's got Absolutely. The right to say what's suffering? And I think living with is a much better term to use if you need to use anything at all. But if you've got, talking about someone with MS, for example, you live with MS, you're there, you're getting on with your life. So people say stupid things like, oh, I'm lucky enough not to be disabled, but I support disability rights, and talks about people who are less fortunate. And also, there's lots of words that get used that reinforce sort of stereotypes, talking about someone being brave for doing something. Oh, you're so brave to overcome the terrible things you're facing. Brave to me is doing a skydive. It's not about living your life. That shouldn't be something that people are considered brave for. That should just be a human right. Yeah, we should only apply brave if we're applying it across the board.
I think that's a really important point, because when we talk about being brave, we shouldn't expect people to have to be brave and to live their lives. The fact that we are in a society where it is considered brave for a disabled person to just go about their life having to overcome all of these barriers, I think that in itself is almost a failure, that it is considered brave, or that disabled people are seen as being more resilient. We don't really have a choice. It's either be resilient and try to navigate all of this stuff, or don't. Mm. So I think this kind of glorification of bravery and resilience is so problematic, because we shouldn't be expecting people to be brave or resilient. Trying to meet people's access requirements, trying to design for inclusion wherever we can, so that nobody has to be brave or resilient just by trying to live their lives, just by trying to come to work, just by trying to go to the supermarket.
It's such a pleasure to be able to hear firsthand and hear directly from you on this as well. And again, in that reflection in my language, my everyday, my considerations. And this, what a great podcast, if I do say so myself. Lex, I want to come to you next in terms of, we've spoken about the reflection on everyday language, we've spoken about the phrases that we need to bin. All of this is to enable, to build better psychological safety for folks in the workplace. So what I'd really love to hear from you is, how is doing all of this work, how does that enable an increased psychological safety in the workplace?
So when we talk about psychological safety, I always think it's really important for me to define it, because I think psychological safety is one of those terms that, I think with the best of intentions, I think it has become a buzzword. And so I think it has started to lose its meaning somewhat. So when we talk about psychological safety, we're talking about how safe do people feel to make mistakes, to call out inappropriate language or behavior, and ultimately, to what extent do people feel like they belong? So when we talk about psychological safety, that's what we're talking about. So if I could give a personal example of maybe the flip side of how exclusive language takes away from psychological safety. So my disabilities are not immediately visible. I'm not a wheelchair user. I don't use mobility aids. If they don't know me, people often assume that I'm not disabled. And when people assume that you're not disabled, they feel very comfortable saying quite ableist things. And that could be talking about mental health conditions as, oh, it's all in their head, or saying things like, oh, everybody's a little bit ADHD, or everybody's on the spectrum. And when that language is used, that immediately makes me feel not psychologically safe. That makes me feel like, okay, so this person's opinions of me and also the disabled community more generally is that everyone's a little bit ADHD, or everyone's a little bit this, everyone's a little bit that. And it's very invalidating. And so I guess to summarize what I'm saying is the language that you use really impacts people. And you, regardless of whether you know if they're disabled or not, the language that you use is so important in creating that environment to make sure everyone feels a sense of belonging. And like, this is why being conscious of the language that you use is so important. If you are making sure to call out when people, especially when people use slurs, but that shouldn't be where the calling out starts and finishes. If people say, if somebody says, oh, someone who suffers with, or everyone's a little bit autistic, honestly, calling that out or like calling it in. So taking the person to the side afterwards and having a private conversation with them afterwards is so valuable. And that can really create a culture of psychological safety, because if a disabled person, if a disabled colleague who you might not know is disabled, sees that and sees that you are showing up for them, that is going to help them feel psychologically safe. But it's also really important to recognize that when we talk about psychological safety, it's not all about language. So of course, like, language is really important, but there are so many other elements of psychological safety. Like, you can be saying all the right things, you can be challenging exclusionary language, but if your organizational policies have not been evaluated to see actually what adverse impact could this have on disabled people, if you have punishing sickness and absence policies, if you say that you have an accessible toilet but it's just used as a broom closet or a storage space, which often happens, that's going to massively detract from people's psychological safety, even while saying all the right things. So language is really important in empowering psychological safety, but it is definitely not the whole story.
Thank you so much, Lex. So very important. And I really hope that's useful for folks to consider, but also for folks to feel seen in that as well. It's not just what you say, it's how you show up. It's all of the things and the consistency for that as well. I've really enjoyed listening to you both, and I feel as though I've learned so much from this, which has been really great for me as well. I want to ask you both, I'll start with Sarah and then I'll come over to you, Lex. Where should organisations start when trying to become more accessible and disability inclusive?
Get an expert involved. Work with an organisation such as Diverse Matters who can come in and help you with that work of identifying where things need to change, which policies might be exclusionary, where your buildings might be problematic for people. It's having expert input, because as brilliant as listening to this or other podcasts is, it's not going to give you all of the knowledge and expertise that you need to make all the changes that you need to. So definitely bring an expert in. Also, involve your disabled staff in decision making in relation to the organization. If you're, again, using a building example, choosing a new building, or you're looking to change policy, then speak to the people who it's going to impact on, and make sure that you have that sort of user involvement, or even better, co-production, working together to develop new ways of working. That's really important.
Oh, I can think of so many things that trying to distill it is really challenging. But just to echo what Sarah said, cannot understate how important and how valuable it is to have an expert work with you on this. And I'm not just saying that because I'm an inclusion consultant. I'm saying that because genuinely, from being a part of the disabled community, from being in this work, it is a very complex, a very nuanced area, and is very commonly seen and asked for in the disabled community. Don't do anything or don't say anything about us without us. So involve us, and where you don't have that expertise internally, having somebody external come in means that you are not relying on there being a pre-existing environment of psychological safety. Because essentially, when you're relying on your disabled employees, that can absolutely have its place, but you need an environment that is psychologically safe in order to have that. And if you don't have that psychological safety, then your disabled employees, if indeed you do have any, are not going to want to come forward and are not going to want to challenge the systems. So having an external person come in to do a full audit of your policies and practices, to do a physical audit of your physical environment, to do an audit of your website, for example, and your website accessibility, but also to support you with setting up staff network groups. Staff network groups, which can include a disability network with meaningful terms of reference, with allocated time, kind of a sensible workload, and is really important in kickstarting this work in a meaningful way. I think two things that I would want to flag additionally. One free resource that is available for companies to look at is the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. You can look at these to essentially get a sense of how to make your website as accessible as possible. The WCAG, for short, you can look them up. It's the WCAG 2.1 standard. And ideally, you want your website to be at the minimum AA certified. Ideally, I want people to take more than one thing away from this. But the one huge thing I want people to take away from this is COVID is very much still a threat, not just to disabled people, but also to all of society. COVID is one of the biggest mass disabling events we have seen in recent memory. So if you want to talk about physical accessibility and you're committed to physical accessibility, that cannot be done without putting in place COVID safety measures. Disabled people are still very much not able to access society because all of the safety measures that were previously in place have now been scrapped. And so it is now essentially the responsibility of businesses to take up the mantle and to really practice disability inclusion. Thank you so much again, Michaela, for inviting us on and for doing this. This has been, I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much.
That's been great. Sarah, Lex, it has been an absolute joy hearing you share everything that you have with us. And so thank you so very much for your time today. And for the listeners, we'll be back soon with our next episode. But thank you so much for listening to the Diverse Matters podcast. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for tuning into the podcast. Please do spread the word about our channel and tune in for our next episode.